This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And what a beautiful day it is, the last day of May. Summer might actually be peaking around here because we had temperatures in the 90s yesterday, more comfortable today, but definitely time to say goodbye to May, which didn't have a lot of great weather. We'll talk about late planting, as a matter of fact, and other things coming up in our editor's roundtable, because we do this once a month. That includes our Prairie Public News Director, Dave Thompson, who's by the microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
With me in studio here in Fargo is Jim Shaw. He's a former television reporter, news director, and he currently writes a column for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead and Forum Communications. Good to be with you.
Good afternoon, Doug. Thanks for having me.
And Renee Jean joins us by phone. She's the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. Hello, Renee.
Hello.
Well, let's start with the news of the day. Dave, another tariff is threatened. It hasn't been imposed yet, but
right.
It is threatened, and this is with a major trading partner with Canada. I mean, China's important, but Mexico's really important.
You know, when you're thinking about the potential for a rewrite of NAFTA with the Mexican and Canadian governments, this is big news because the president wants to impose perhaps a 5% tariff on Mexican goods if the government does not stop the flow of immigrants into the United States. That's going to have a huge effect because he said he'd like to increase that for, you know, like per month until, you know, Mexico stops the flow of immigrants. I think it's going to have a major effect on our farms.
Now, he's talking about it going up 5% a month until the 1st of October, up to 25%.
Right.
That would be pretty huge, as a matter of fact. This tariff, though, is different than the one against Canada, let's not go there yet, China,
no.
Because with China, it was a trade relationship issue. With this, it's illegal immigration or people who are coming here trying to present themselves as refugees. And I don't know how Mexico resolves that.
I don't either. And we're talking about the refugees who aren't from Mexico. They're just coming through Mexico.
Yeah,
they're from other Central American countries. And they are just traveling through and they are trying to escape for their lives. They have no poverty. They are facing gang violence. So how do you stop them from trying to escape their countries and go through Mexico? You can't. And I don't know how this ends well for the American consumer. I don't know how this ends well for the American farmer. But what happens is Trump's base sticks with him no matter what. So unless his base starts turning on him, President Trump will keep doing things like this.
Well, a piece of his Senate base, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, has certainly been sounding the alarm. He is very concerned about this additional trade relationship complication. And, of course, you mentioned the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement is still in negotiation. It's in play. And this was ill-timed for that.
Yeah, very, very poor timing. Again, no good is going to come out of this. And I highly doubt this will have any effect on those Central American people who are trying to go through Mexico to get the U.S. This is not going to stop them. When you are scared for your life and you can't make a living, you think they're going to stop going to Mexico because Mexico was hit with a tariff? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, they're not paying the tariffs, that's for sure. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in this article I saw from the New York Times, that's the nation's largest business group, is exploring the grounds on which they might mount a legal challenge against the president's proposal. Against this, this is just a proposal, and, you know, we've had a little whiplash in trade relationship dialogue, pretty bellicose on our side. So perhaps the president will retreat from this, but it doesn't seem to be in his nature. So this is something that is another kind of double whammy. Renee, is there any talk about the tariffs around your part of the state in terms of the effect or reaction? I mean, there are plenty of people who support the president. There are those who are very concerned about commodity relations with China and Mexico now. What are you hearing where you are?
Well, you know, I think I could echo what the previous person just said. There's a lot of support for Trump out here, regardless, seemingly, of what he does. But there's also a lot of pain out there with this is the fifth straight year for low commodity prices. The uncertainty is causing a great deal of anxiety for a lot of farmers. I talked with several of them trying to decide what do you plant. You know, they have to make these decisions. They've had to make these decisions under a cloud of uncertainty, and I do think that's taking a toll.
Well, at this point, I did have a chance to talk with North Dakota U.S. Senator John Hoeven last week about the possibility of some assistance for North Dakota farmers, farmers nationwide who are affected by these tariffs and difficult trade relationships. And, Dave, there has been this $16 billion
yes.
trade package
That's right.
that is going to be used to sort of offset the pain, particularly for soybean growers and other major commodities. But that in itself is controversial.
It is because, again, it's talking about, you know, direct payments to farmers. And there are some people who are a little uneasy with that, even though, you know, a lot of farmers are getting hurt. You think about China. China has basically put a stop now on – or basically for the moment has put a stop on buying soybeans. So there's some real pain out there.
Well, the indication is that they're buying soybeans from Brazil. They're supplanting
right.
us with a new supplier.
Right.
Well, farmers have made it clear that they want trade mm-hmm. and they want markets. They don't want handouts. They are forced to take these handouts because of the tariffs. But where does that money come from? You know, that just is a vicious cycle when it comes to our budget deficit. And handouts, the ultimate best long-term scenario is let's get the trade markets going again. Let's get rid of the tariffs. But, again, getting back to the politics of it, the farmers say they don't want handouts. They want the trade. They want the markets. But they still support Trump. And they willingly take this. So he's their guy no matter what, even though he imposes policies that are not in their best interests.
It could be painful because the North Dakota soybean crop was valued last year at $2.2 billion. 72% of that crop is exported, and the number one export destination is China. So it is going to hurt some growers. There's no question of that. And the other issue here is what happens after the aid payment. We had the $12 billion last year, the $16 billion proposed now this year. That can't go on forever. And in the meantime, the markets are changing. If China isn't buying from the U.S., if it just goes to Brazil in the future, yes, there's a world demand for soybeans, but gaining those markets, gaining those relationships isn't like just clicking your fingers. So this is a knotty problem. And I suspect one that we'll be talking about in the next Editor's Roundtable at this point.
Very well be.
Okay. Let's talk about something out in Renee's part of the state, and yours, Dave, for that matter. Oil and gas production, that is still bullish in the state, right?
Oh, it sure is. Oh. And Renee can talk to it more than I can about there was a record, like daily record, a well that was drilled in McKenzie County. Is that correct?
Yeah, I saw that. I haven't had a chance to read that story yet. But, yeah, that's pretty exciting. I mean, the industry just continues to keep raising the bar on the kind of production that they can get from these wells. That's pretty astounding, actually.
Yeah, and I noticed something, and I don't know where I ran across this, but I ran across it a couple of sources that said if you go by county in the United States, McKenzie County is the top oil-producing county in the United States
wow.
now. So we're talking about,
yeah.
you know, it's going great guns again.
What's the daily output now?
I'd have to look that up. But they were talking about the production in McKenzie County when the governor visited Watford City for his Main Street. And the lieutenant governor, Brent Sanford, made the comment that McKenzie County is now producing as much oil as some of the oil countries.
mm-hmm. Well, I note that Norway, which has this $1 trillion trust fund that they have built up because of the oil revenues that that country has accumulated, Norway pumps 1.6 million gallons a day. That's not much more than North Dakota.
I actually think North Dakota might be higher than that by now.
Well, isn't that interesting?
I'd have to look it up. Yeah.
I mean, that makes that legacy fund potential look pretty interesting.
It does.
Right. And what are they going to do with that? That'll be the interesting part.
You know, there's going to be that interesting study over the next 2 years that is a mandatory study from the legislature, and it's going to have the leadership on and the chairman of the appropriations and tax, finance and tax committees, and they're going to say, okay, what are we going to do with the proceeds out there? They would like to, I'm not saying they need to, but they want to ratchet it into some, you know, infrastructure funds or something like that. You know, give it a purpose and not just let it go into the general fund for general spending.
Well, they need to figure it out because there's a lot of ill feeling about that fund.
Boy, it's sitting there
ever. It's sitting there with billions of dollars. There's a lot of needs for that money, and nobody knows what to do with it. And a lot of people say, come on, we need some help here. You got the money and you're not using it. That's frustrating.
It is.
And I think taxpayers don't expect their government agencies to be banking institutions.
Amen. I think you're right, especially when they look at their tax statements, particularly that especially long leg on the tripod, which is property taxes of the stool, the three-legged stool that we always talk about in terms of tax support for North Dakota, income, sales, and property tax. There is a downside, or at least another side, I should say, about oil and gas production in the state, and that is the viewscape issue, the encroachment on sensitive lands, rivers, and things like that, Dave. And that has been that outcry has emerged again, particularly around Theodore Roosevelt Park, the Little Missouri River, those kinds of places.
It is, and you think about the complaints about the planned refinery at Belfield, and that could be a problem. Some people say it could be a problem with the viewshed of Theodore Roosevelt Park, especially. And yeah, there's some backlash, and that's undeniable. And it comes down to how do you manage growth? Where do you allow these things to go? I know that there are going to be some hard decisions coming up.
Well, natural gas flaring, they haven't met the benchmark yet, have they?
No. As a matter of fact, there was an 88% benchmark in terms of gas capture. They're actually at 80% in the last report. So there's a problem that they're trying to solve. And part of it could be solved at least temporarily. If you listen to some of the experts, they say there's new oil gas production plants coming online, collection pipelines that are coming online. That will do for maybe a year. But after that, as you notice, if you look at the curves that they put together, as oil production may kind of level off, gas production keeps going up because it's very interesting. When we first started talking about this, they said as oil production would go down in the Bakken, gas production would continue to rise. You know, it's kind of a different curve there.
Well, we're going to take a break now, but we will get back to our editor's roundtable with Dave Thompson. You just heard him, and Jim Shaw, and Renee, Gene with the Williston Herald, because I want to talk about a story that Renee wrote for the Herald that uses one of those gas byproducts, ethane, which is very intriguing. So we'll talk about that after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, offering certified guardianship services to older adults and individuals with disabilities. Services are available in Minnesota and North Dakota. Learn more at lssmn.org/guardian. And by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
It's the Editor's Roundtable on Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us on our Prairie Public Radio Network. We've got Dave Thompson, our news director here at Prairie Public, Jim Shaw, who is a forum columnist, and Renee Jean, the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. And Renee, I'm talking about this story that you wrote about a week ago, North Dakota's first suitor for plastics plant files for bankruptcy. Several factors are aligning, however, to make the second attempt more likely to succeed. This is an exhaustive report. Very interesting. Tell our listeners about it.
Well, so I've been on vacation, actually. When I came back, I read the story about how the legislature passed a tax incentive to try to attract the petrochemical industry. And so I just kind of started Googling around to learn more about it because I'm kind of new around here. And I happened to discover that the first suitor had filed for bankruptcy. So that resulted in the story about what's different this time around and why do we think that it might work this time. And so one of the things that I was told is that the first time we're really missing two steps to get to a plastics plant. And by that first failure kind of helped them learn what they needed to do the second time around, which is to build this intermediary plant that will prepare the ethanes for a plastic plant. So I thought that was pretty interesting to tell people, you know, why is it going to work this time?
And there's no small potatoes here. This initial proposal by Badlands NGLS was about a $4 billion polyethylene manufacturing facility, and that was years ago. I remember actually being at an oil conference and hearing this presentation and thinking, wow, that's a lot bigger thing than I was expecting to hear about today. But, of course, I hadn't heard about it much since, and now I see your story. So what else is being done to maybe facilitate this new industry?
So in addition to building that intermediate step, they're looking for the correct location. And my understanding from talking to the lieutenant governor and several others is that it's going to have to be in northwestern North Dakota somewhere because they need underground salt caverns to store the ethanes in, as well as possibly liquid CO2. So somewhere here in northwestern North Dakota. And then I was talking with the Tioga economic developer, and they are located near salt deposits that might be suitable for that. They also have the Hess plant, which produces ethanes. I think the Hess plant was the first plant in the state to do that. And they recently added to their capacity or their ability to produce ethane. So I think that's pretty interesting information. I'm not saying it's going there, but I mean that might be a possibility. Tioga has got a coalition together to try to see if they can be the one.
So the state's geology and its ethane availability is a positive, but it's competing, I assume, with parts of the country, especially along the Gulf Coast, where you have all these petrochemical plants that are already producing this stuff. So is there an incentivization that is part of this as well?
Well, you know, a couple years ago, or maybe it was even 3 or 4 years ago, it's when I first came here, a company had done a feasibility study on having a plastics plant in North Dakota. And one of the things that company talked about was the geographic advantage of having a plant here. So if we did build one, we are geographically advantaged for supplying certain markets in the United States.
Ah, that's interesting for a change.
We do have enough product so that such an investment could pay itself back. It is a huge investment, though. So I think my gut feeling is that whoever does this has got to be kind of like the refinery that's located near the park from North Dakota and wants to help its state diversify.
So this has the potential, I assume, to provide some significant job growth?
Hopefully. I mean, and more jobs of a more permanent nature and perhaps a little less dependent on the ups and downs of the oil price environment.
So a value added, I mean, we're not just exporting crude oil then. We're exporting a product that has been processed somewhat. I mean, maybe not finished plastic goods, but the nuggets are the raw material to make stuff out of polyethylene.
Right, because your state is so far not capturing, it's only capturing a tiny fraction of the total wealth chain that's available with these products. There's so much more that could be done with value-added industries.
So this is one to watch, and Renee will be counting on you to keep us in touch on this one. Dave, in the meantime, alternative energy, especially wind, continues to grow in the state.
And it's continuing to grow for North Dakota, but also because a lot of the power goes on that grid, you know, the MISO grid. And you have Xcel Energy, which will, it says it wants to get out of the fossil fuel business as much as it can as soon as possible. You know, it's got some mandates from Minnesota, but I think it's by 2050 it wants to get rid of all its coal-fired power plants. And it might be even earlier than 2050, since they're shutting down that one in Becker, Minnesota, and they're shutting down another one that's in the suburban Twin Cities area. So you've got the wind power possibilities there. And I was also interested that one wind farm that was proposed for Burley County, which got kind of a foul of a township that didn't want it, is actually going to be moving, you know, the permit to Logan County, it looks like, Logan and Emmons counties. So that, and that's a fairly pretty big wind farm, too, I think 200 megawatts.
And coal is contracting a bit. You mentioned the Becker plant in Minnesota. That is a huge coal-fired power plant. And when you drive by it on Highway 94, you can't miss those smokestacks.
Correct.
And coal plants are contracting in North Dakota because natural gas is proving to be a good peak supplier.
Well, if you think about it, you think about the Heskett plant north of Mandan is now going to shut down its coal boilers and go to, and be a natural gas peaking plant. Now, everybody, we've all been talking about baseload power, but it's interesting that you've got wind and then you've got natural gas that helps out when the wind isn't blowing. So it's a whole new dynamic in power production, and the Public Service Commission notices this. The Public Service Commission is weighing in on it to make sure the rules are in place for reclaiming wind farms, solar panels, and natural gas plants as they age.
Well,
so there's
a
lot of things at play here.
This is part of the reason behind the move for a smart grid, which enables this exchange of power a little more easily, I take it.
Mm-hmm.
And, Jim, there's politics here because we're hearing candidates starting to talk about alternative energy as a political campaign issue. We're hearing global warming, climate change, whichever term you prefer, being used on the campaign trail.
Right. Certainly on the national level.
Yeah. Not so much here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Not so much here. Right.
But it affects us because we're exporting a lot of energy.
Exactly. Exactly. And this could be an issue in the 2020 campaign, especially Trump will stick to the old traditional forms of energy and fight for them, including coal and oil. And candidates, especially Inslee and the others, will be pushing for wind and solar and others that might be more environmentally friendly.
That's Jay Inslee,
the governor of Washington. I mean, his campaign, his number one issue is climate change, and he's had no traction on that, but he's trying to break through as the climate change candidate.
And Washington State, pretty importantly, is trying to impose these regulations on the volatility of oil from the Bakken going through Washington State, which would have to do to get to a port. So this is all in play and stuff we should be aware of in North Dakota.
Exactly.
Well, we're in our editor's roundtable. That was Jim Shaw. He's a forum columnist. And Renee Jean is joining us from Williston. She's a assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. Dave Thompson is, of course, our Prairie Public News director. We'll be back with more of our editor's roundtable after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota has a new cabinet agency. It's called the Department of Environmental Quality. It was created by moving the Division of Environmental Quality out of the State Health Department. The new agency has 160 employees. It will be responsible for such things as air and water quality.
What we're going to do is that we're going to continue to do what we've done in the past.
Dave Glott is the director of the DEQ. He's been with the health department since 1983. So what is the new agency going to do?
Common sense environmental protection to the citizens of the state, using science and the law, great professionals to make sure this happens moving forward.
The transition to a new DEQ began in 2017 when the legislature passed the bill creating the agency. It takes time, and at the end of April, all the requirements were met to satisfy the Federal Environmental Protection Agency that the DEQ would be granted primacy over air and water quality.
The importance of primacy is that it's a federal regulation that is implemented by the state at the state level. The states are in a better position to really know the issues at the state level, and I will say nationally, states implement 96% of the federal regulations at the state level. Better efficiency, understanding the issues, better solutions on the outcome, rather than having somebody from Washington, D.C. or Denver tell us what to do.
Glatt says he wants the staff to also remember they're working for the people of North Dakota, so he pledges his agency will be helpful and transparent. Minnesota Congressman Colin Peterson says President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on Mexico will make it almost impossible to ratify the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Peterson is the chair of the House Agriculture Committee. He says the tariffs will not come without a penalty.
You know, if I put a tariff on dairy products or whatever, I think there'll be some kind of retaliation, I would expect. You know, and then we'll get into some dispute situation over NAFTA. I don't think there's any good outcome out of this, from what I can see.
Trump says he plans to impose tariffs starting at 5% and increase to 25% if Mexico does not convince him that it's doing more against illegal immigration. The tariffs go into effect June 10th. And Warren, a city of about 1,500 in northwestern Minnesota, has bragging rights to one of the few remaining drive-in theaters in the upper Midwest. A family-run operation, Skyview Drive-In, a mile west of town, has a booming business and has just opened for another season. Tom Novak says the drive-in was started by his father decades ago and draws viewers from everywhere.
Of course, we get people from Grand Forks, Fargo, Winnipeg, for that matter. Well, we also get people from the Twin Cities that come up. Now, granted, they may be vacationing or visiting family, but they love to come out to the drive-in, too. And I'll tell you what, we've had people from all around the world, actually, especially lately, when they're in the area, one of their stops, their hit list, is to go to the drive-in theater.
Novak says Skyview Drive-In has kept up with state-of-the-art motion picture technology and has first-run movies on its regular schedule and has become a family go-to spot for entertainment. Skyview also has more than 14,000 followers on Facebook. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you for joining us on our Main Street Editors Roundtable. Of course, it's the last day in May, a beautiful day, so we're glad you're hunkered down around the radio. But we've got some more issues to talk about with our assembled editors. Dave Thompson's a regular, our Prairie Public News Director, Jim Shaw, who's a former reporter, TV news director, and currently writes a column for Forum Communications, and Renee Jean, the assistant managing editor of the Williston Herald. There is a crisis on campus, according to a story I saw in the forum. North Dakota College facing low morale, management issues, higher ed leaders says. This was written by April Baumgarten. There seems to be, Dave, a little difference of opinion on the North Dakota Board of Higher Education about whether it's a crisis or not.
You can definitely say that. It was board member Kathleen Nesent who said that it was a crisis. Nesent talked about that. She chairs the audit committee of the Board of Higher Education. She said this performance audit shows some deficiencies there, and there was some problems with a conflict of interest regarding one of the vice presidents and Flint Communications. There's a lot of things at play here, and this goes back to when a delegation supporting this idea of a career academy to be built in Fargo to be run by NDSCS came to the Board of Higher Education. It was not specifically on the agenda. It was just on the agenda as a report, but this whole group came in and said, hey, give us the authority to start fundraising. Kathleen Nesson was the chair of the board at the time, and she says this is not on the agenda. It shouldn't be on the agenda, but they decided to go ahead with it. I think it was a 6-2 vote, and she's always been a little bit uncomfortable with the way that was handled, and then this audit came out, and it depends, I guess, on who you talk to, who you're listening to. The board chair, Don Morton, is very much in favor of not only building that career academy, but also says that he's getting a lot of positive feedback from the business community in Fargo and Wahpeton, saying that things are going pretty well.
Well, one of the players here you mentioned is that Vice President Tony Grenberg, who is also on the Fargo City Commission.
Right.
And so there, and now he works for the school in Wahpeton, and this is a facility they want to expand into Fargo. And you get the impression that there are also differences of opinion about whether the faculty and staff at the State School of Science are affected by this, whether there's a morale issue there. Again, there's a difference of opinion about that.
There's a difference of opinion. Also, you heard from the student member of the Board of Higher Education at that meeting, where she said that she's been hearing from a lot of NDSCS or North Dakota College of Science students who say, hey, things are going pretty well. We like the way things are going, so they don't see the problem. So there are so many stories out there. It's going to have to, you know, kind of sort through and what's going to happen now. I guess there's going to be another meeting of the audit committee next month. That's before the June meeting of the Board of Higher Education. And they're going to determine whether or not there's going to be some kind of oversight from the chancellor's office over what's happening down at the College of Science.
Well, John Richmond is the president, and he's claiming that nobody has really talked to him from the board. But I don't think he's unaware about all of this is going on.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many ramifications from this. Number one, we've seen a lot of the business leaders rally around John Richmond just mm-hmm. to kind of prop him up. Number two, I think what we're seeing is this is a divisive issue about how much of the NDSCS should be in Fargo and how much should be in Wahpeton. And I think many people in Wahpeton are a little bothered that Fargo seems to be growing when the main campus, when the school is based in Wahpeton. The third issue, of course, is the audit, which uncovered some of this stuff, and then consequently what the legislature passed to tie the hands of the state auditor, and now that could be referred. So this issue is not going away anytime soon. And then a fourth, even more side issue, I'm thinking from a Fargo perspective, is Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney is term limited, so he can't run for re-election. And up until now, I thought Tony Grenberg was the front runner to replace Tim Mahoney. This could be a bump in the road for Tony Grenberg to become the next mayor of Fargo.
Wow. It's a story with an awful lot of layers. Let's just put it that way.
All sorts of them.
Well, we're going to talk about these referred measures and that auditor's one as well in just a moment. But we need to talk about the University of North Dakota is about to lose its president. He starts at Mark Kennedy starts at the University of Colorado in the middle of June. So they're looking for one, Dave.
And, they're looking for one, yes.
And they've got an interim one.
The interim one is Josh Wynn, who is the dean of the UND Medical School, somebody who is well-respected in political circles, someone who is well-respected on campus, seems to be pretty apolitical in terms of partisan political, but has been credited with the growth of the medical school. And have you ever been to the UND Medical School building, you can see that growth reflected there. It's a beautiful facility, and he's trying to expand to get more people in and to help out rural areas. So he's seen as, I'm going to put it this way, one of the good guys on campus.
Well, Joshua Wynn will be a guest of ours on Main Street next Thursday, so we look forward to talking to him about all of that.
Fascinating guy.
Meanwhile, the search process. You know, Mark Kennedy didn't last that long.
He didn't last that long, and the search process, there's a little bit of consternation among some board members because there's some pretty good money spent on search firms that look for presidents. And at least one board member, and that's Dan Traynor from Devil's Lake, would like to ratchet that back a little bit. And there were a few, shall we say, conditions put on the search committee that's going to be appointed. Number one, 11 members only. Most of the time there's been 15 members or more. Secondly, they're going to try to hold down the cost. They're not going to seek the search firm. The search firm has already been, you know, or I should say that the committee is going to choose the search firm and not the chancellor's office. And if they're going to hold it under $100,000, well, they can just take two bids on that and go for that. And I have heard that there are a couple of North Dakota firms that might be interested in doing a search for the presidency there. So it's a little bit of churn, let's put it that way.
I think that in this search, they will really be looking for a North Dakotan, if at all possible.
I think you're right.
And that might mean another search at that institution.
I think they really got burned by Kennedy, and they learned a lesson. Kelly, they brought him in from the outside. That never turned out to be a great fit. They need to find the North Dakotan, I think, to have someone come in who already knows the culture and the politics of the state and how higher education is treated, and who can work with the legislature and work with the governor. And there are some good people involved there. And the second thing is they want to make sure they have somebody who wants to stay. Mm-hmm. They don't want to make this an ongoing effort. Mark Kennedy clearly was looking to leave almost the day he arrived. And they want somebody who really loves this state. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to predict that they may end up with someone like Steve Shirley at Minot State University. Very highly regarded. He's been in the system for a while as a college president. He's a North Dakotan. To me, he would be a great fit for the university and for the state.
Well, one thing that is always a complication when it comes to a presidential search is sort of the transparency when you get to the point of identifying who the candidates are, because there's
It's easier this year because they only have to identify the final three, whereas in the past you had to identify everybody, and that scared people away.
Right, because they're worried about where they're currently working.
Right,
that gets to be a political hot potato for them, and that's one of the complications for these high level jobs makes it difficult in a way to find the right people and the right timing. And on top of that. Renee, any perspective from you on this issue on the eastern edge of the state?
Well, watching it all with interest.
Well, let's go to something we can all be interested in, and that is this mandatory interim study to look at internet privacy and security. I have had the same experience that Jim Casper mentions. He's a representative from Fargo, Republican.
Right.
He said in the story you wrote, Dave, a year or so ago, I bought some ties online. Within hours, I had two other offers of ties from other companies. I've actually looked at a picture of a product online and within seconds seen pitches for variations of that product.
I believe we probably all have, don't you?
Yeah. Oh,
I know
yeah.
I have. I know I have. And
as have I.
And
I looked up a tent for a friend, and for a month after that, I was followed by that tent every site that I went to.
I've seen the same thing.
With an ad for it.
and it's not necessarily the same company. That's the thing that's intriguing, because this data is out there, and it must be being exchanged in ways we can only imagine.
And they wonder if these companies, if you're on Facebook or something like that, and I don't mean to point out Facebook as one, but you do order something on there, and then, or you have some data, something that you said you liked, and that information might be sold for a profit to some other companies. That's the whole point about this story. The study is going to look at that entire thing. And Representative Casper, who is basically one of those constitutional scholars, and he says he believes it's a constitutional ownership right that you own your own data and it shouldn't be bought or sold.
Well, we will watch this mandatory interim study with great interest. I will, for sure. We talked about this, and I want to get this in. Jim, you mentioned the referral of the auditor's decision by the legislature. There's also a referral effort, Dave, isn't there, for the new proposed presidential library?
That is correct. But there's a little twist on that in terms of the presidential library. The bill to allow $15 million to be spent and $35 million to be borrowed from the Bank of North Dakota came with an emergency clause. So the minute it was signed, it took effect. So the referral is not going to have a direct effect on that per se. But if it does pass, there might be a question about does that money have to be paid back. I find it extremely interesting because there are a few things that the legislature has done that has gotten the ire of some residents. For example, this idea of making it harder to have a constitutional measure take effect if it is a citizen initiative.
Yeah.
The legislature put one on, says, okay, you pass the initiative, you have to bring it to the legislature. If the legislature says no, it goes back on the ballot. And then if you say yes, it's going to go on. But it, legislature says it gives them a chance to weigh in on these constitutional measures.
Well, I suspect that people who vote on constitutional measures and people who initiate measures might have a different opinion about that.
Right. And remember, Dustin Gavrilo's group has come up with one that basically says you can't do this. So
okay.
I found that very interesting.
I think historically people cherish their right in North Dakota to bring measures to the public to be voted on and approved. And I can't see North Dakota voters allowing that right to be restricted the way the legislature intends it to be.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Our editor's roundtable has run out of time. We thank you all for participating today. Jim Shaw, always a pleasure to see you
and
have you in the studio. Renee Jean, thanks for joining us. Renee is with the Williston Herald, and Dave Thompson, you're a regular on Fridays. Always a pleasure to have you on the air, Dave.
Thank you.
And, of course, we're going to talk about a new movie with Madeline next.
When Saigon fell, this desperate Vietnamese mother had to drop her baby from a helicopter 20 feet above the deck of a U.S. ship.
There's no communication because the noise is so bad between the people on the deck and the people in the helicopter. We assumed they were going to jump, but we never expected the first one to be a baby.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason.
With Good Reason, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
There's the fanfare. It's time to talk about another new movie with our resident critic here at Prairie Public, Matt Holine. And this time, Matt, I've been to the movie, too.
Wow, good. Booksmart,
yeah.
The latest teen comedy, R-rated, directed by Olivia Wilde. Who knew she had these kind of directing chops?
Yeah, she's great.
Her partner Jason Sudeikis is in the movie. He plays the principal at this Los Angeles high school. And the film focuses on two soon-to-be graduated seniors, played by Beanie Feldstein. She is the sister of Jonah Hill. And if you didn't know that and you watch the film, you can tell she's the sister of Jonah Hill. There's definitely a resemblance.
I didn't know that. That's
Caitlin Dever is her best friend who plays Amy, and she is really kind of a rising actress. I like her a lot. These are really smart girls. They're going to Yale and Columbia. They don't party. They do everything by the book. And on the last day of school, the Beanie Feldstein character who plays Molly has an epiphany that they probably missed out. And they're going to go to the big graduation party at this at the class jock, the boy that all the girls like. He's having a big party at his aunt's house, and they're going to go and have a good time. So like a lot of teen films, Doug, this takes place over the course of about one day. American Graffiti did that. Hollywood Nights did that. Dazed and Confused. And I think those are the best teen comedies or teen film when they focus on that one moment. This is it. Nothing will ever be the same after this. Now, it is a raunchy film. It's foul-mouthed. It is funny. The chemistry with the two leads really carries this movie. Plus, Olivia Wilde makes some great directing choices. There's some really bravura sequences involving when both girls kind of accidentally get fed some strawberries that are laced. That's a hilarious scene that ensues there. They have great chemistry with each other. Jason Sudeikis is hilarious as their principal, who they call Principal Brown. Some of the supporting cast are really funny as well. They have these two kind of side friends, Jared and Gigi, who are really strange kids, and they're oddballs too. So you've got all the pecking order of high school, you know, this group. But of course, it's all played for laughs. So it's not realistic like Eighth Grade was last year. You know, that was a great film, but that was a realistic look at middle school. This, of course, is melodramatic. It's comedy. Everything is heightened. There's a heightened sense of humor going on that probably would not happen, but that's what makes it funny. And I did like this film a lot. It's not finding an audience, though, Doug, and that's too bad. It could be the R rating. Could be that they released it in wide release. That might have been a slight mistake. I'm not sure. That's what a friend of mine in the industry thinks. But maybe the word of mouth will get people there.
Well, I had a little bit of a Ferris Bueller moment as I watched it, because as you mentioned, a lot happens in one day, and there are plot twists that come right out of the blue. But it's very entertaining. Now, it is foul-mouthed, as you say, but come on. I went to high school.
That's how a lot of kids talk. And as I put it with these films, there's that little cherry on top. Everything is done a little more dramatic than it would be in real life, but that's where the comedy comes in. So what I'm trying to tell people is, don't go expecting this to be eighth grade, which was a very realistic kind of bare bones, warts and all, look at middle school. This is a funny comedy. It's foul mouth. There are some good scenes, though, Doug, which are more serious, which have to do with gender, which have to do with the pecking order in high school and who dates who and things like that. Those are some interesting moments as well. And I think what it really captures, too, is that things will never be the same moment. That was so well captured by George Lucas in American Graffiti. They will never have this moment again. Things are never the same after high school, and you lose track of people, and it gets that across as well, but it gets it across in kind of an amusing way. I never thought the film was preachy. You always kind of felt maybe this is going to border into preachy territory. They actually make fun of kind of modern gender things that are talked about in the news. They make fun of the theater kids. They're made mock of in the film in a hilarious way. So I like that they poke fun at all the different groups, and it's not kind of the PC world where we can't make fun of groups. And that's what the film does so well, and everyone's kind of an equal opportunity, including the girls. You know, they get made fun of for being too smart, for being too serious about life, and then they kind of have second thoughts about that.
Well, there's this self-discovery that they go through that's really, I think, intriguing and informative and interesting. I'm surprised, as perhaps you were, that the audience for this hasn't really shown up. Because when I went to the movie, we were among a very few people in the theater, and this thing strikes me as having legs.
I think it has cult legs, Doug. I think this is the kind of film that people, I think teenagers will still be talking about in a few years now. But as we talk about on the show, Doug, you know, where's the audience? So are teenage kids going to this? I don't know.
I didn't see any.
I didn't see any there either. So was the marketing off? Should they have released it in kind of a limited independent film type release after people saw it and it got distribution deal? I don't know. That's where the movie business gets real tricky, about how to market things and who to market them to. So if high schoolers aren't going to this film, if you and I are in the audience, Doug, that's why the film's in trouble financially. Now, hopefully it'll have legs. Maybe the word of mouth will spread and people will start going, and maybe they'll say, oh, let's go to this film. Maybe college students will go. I don't know. But clearly something was missed in the marketing here.
Well, nothing was missed in the casting, and the direction is wonderful.
Olivia Wilde certainly has a flair for directing here. I want to credit the screenwriters, all female, Suzanne Vogel, Emily Halpern, Sarah Haskins, and Katie Silberman. And as I said, two winning performances from Caitlin Dever and Beanie Feldstein.
All right. Well, here is our Oscar trivia question of the week. Probably too easy, because it's an oddball question, and I know how your mind works, Matt. The only write-in Oscar winner. Oh, he's thinking.
That's back in the 30s, right?
That's when they had
write-ins.
That's correct.
I know Betty Davis almost won as a write-in for Of Human Bondage, but that's not right.
This is a winner. This is for
cinematography. Is it Becky Sharp?
No. It's A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Midsummer Night's Dream, 1935.
And Hal Moore
was
the cinematographer. Okay. We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 31st. On this date, in 1906, the Hope Pioneer newspaper noted that two new North Dakota towns were on the rise. According to the newspaper, both Mackville and Tolna promised to be booming in short order. Both were in Nelson County, on a new extension of the Great Northern Railroad. Demand for land in and near the towns was high. The Northern Town and Land Company sold almost 100 lots in one day. The newspaper was quite sure that the towns would take off so quickly that it would seem they had sprung up as if by magic. The newspaper mentioned that both towns offered opportunities for businesses, including hotels and restaurants. Mackville was located near the Cheyenne River. It was known as prime agricultural land. The town was named for local inhabitants, many of whom had surnames that started with MC or Mac. Early businesses included an elevator, a bank, a blacksmith shop, and a general store. The town never took off quite like the pioneer had envisioned. The largest population was 626 in 1950. According to the 2010 census, the population had dropped to 349. Although small, Mackville soldiers on. There's a school for students in kindergarten through grade 6, while older students attend school in nearby Petersburg. A campground in Mackville is busy throughout the summer. The other new town was Tolna, 12 miles northwest of Mackville. In the early 1880s, David Newton Tallman had organized the Dakota Development Company, which developed town sites along the Great Northern Railroad. He was especially interested in Tolna and owned the quarter section on which it was built. The town was a play on Tallman's last name. He named streets for his daughters Helen, Esther, Gertrude, Margaret, and Marjorie. Tallman promised free land to the first baby born in town. That was Lillian Tolna Heald, born in Tolna on September 26, 1906. The population of Tolna never topped 300. According to the 2010 census, the population stood at 166. Although it was always small, Tolna proved to be tenacious, and it continues to have a thriving community. Businesses include a market, a construction company, a cafe, a fire department, and banks. Among the area's attractions are hunting, fishing, and camping. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Don Gagne. More than a dozen Democratic candidates are in San Francisco for the party's California convention. That state's presidential primary has moved up on the calendar, meaning it'll play a greater role in picking a nominee. Some say it's an audition for a crowded Democratic field. We'll bring you the latest from there tomorrow on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Saturday at 4 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll talk with an expert on post-traumatic stress disorder. June is PTSD Awareness Month, and Dr. Lori Nadell offers personal and professional perspectives. We'll also talk with Josh Knutson. He used to coach esports at the University of Jamestown. Now he's the esports and virtual reality director for a Moorhead-based computer company. Competitive multiplayer video games are becoming popular spectator sports. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.